This is Barry Teicher of the Oral History Project. Today is Friday, October 13th, the year 2000. I'm in a conference room in Steenbach Library with Norm Sunstedt, and we're going to continue the discussion we began yesterday. We left off yesterday. You were going to talk about the child care issue as it developed at Married Student Housing, Eagle Heights.
Prior to my arrival, there were, I believe, two child cares, maybe three, in family housing. There's one in University Houses, I guess maybe just one in Eagle Heights. I think maybe that was it. There were a couple others on campus, Bernie's Place, I don't remember where else. At any rate,
Bernie's Place was a little daycare thing for you.
Yeah, I think under the administration of the union, there were a couple of these. This time, I guess I'd say the 80s, was a struggle and continuing with more need for child care because in families both adults were working, or one was a student and one was supporting the other working, and there were less family support systems to help, like grandparents and so on. And so that much of that started before I got here, although it was really kind of an afterthought, a slapped together kind of thing, and there weren't sophisticated programs, or I don't think much even of a philosophy of early childhood development in place. Through my time, the culture of the world was changing to hold a higher priority for child care and more pressure indicating the need for child care. I think paralleling very closely, equal rights for women, opportunities for employment, just the world changed. And so we did more in that area, and it was an important part of the community services function in family housing. The commitment of the staff that I mentioned yesterday, Laura Shear, that sort of student affairs philosophy in residence halls applied to family housing. What are the needs? How can we help support students? Child care was a big part of that. And then, of course, other programs that they do, counseling for families and providing opportunities for counselors to serve in the Family Housing Community Center, serve families. Going on in the child care thing, just because that's kind of a subject, I think, I don't remember the timing on this. It seems like it was later in my time, probably in the last 5 years. There were enough child care operations around the campus, and the chancellor, somebody, I guess it was Shalala, maybe, of course, Mary Rouse, as Dean of Students, mm-hmm. was a part of it, thinking that we needed to somehow or another place child cares under some organization in the university. And the decision was to put it with housing. And I don't know that I ever finally found out what the thinking about that was. There were a couple things I can think of. One of them was that we had more of the child cares in housing. Of the five or six that existed on campus, three at the time, I believe, were in university housing. So it made sense. Well, if they're running a bunch of them, why don't they run more? But I think another one was, child care is a bit like housing. And housing has a lot to do with feeding and bathrooms and, mm-hmm. and sleeping space. Mm-hmm. And in other words, non-academic space. And so I think that might have been also why they thought that it might go there. And then sort of the student affairs philosophy of student development that we had for adolescence, in a sense, late adolescence, I think they might have thought, well, maybe there's that skill in housing as well, and or at least appreciation for it, learning outside of the classroom. And so Shalala assigned child care to me, and then working with the Dean of Students and others who were concerned, John Wiley was concerned, others, we hired a child care director, who's Lynn Adelson at this point, was Chip Donahue was the first one, who tried to work on just anything that would help the child cares on campus, see about whether we could increase them, provide more services for infants, concerned with a variety of things. And there were a number of people who had a deep interest in that, and our job was to try to listen to them and see if we could make things work better. It's a difficult area because it requires, it doesn't make money, and there isn't a history of people paying the full cost of childcare, so it's a tough one. And I think it's continuing to grow as a concern in the culture, and I think Lynn Adelson is doing a good job, and I suspect it will, we'll see more child cares, more commitment to that, more support, and as there's a difficulty employing enough people to do the work at the university, yeah. child care is an important thing to provide. So that's the piece on child care.
So it's pretty much become just a standard part of housing operations at this point. When you said Mary Rouse assigned it to housing, did you guys have any input in that at all?
Actually, I think Shalala decided it was going to go with housing.
Sure.
Shalala had a history when she was a young person in graduate school. She worked in housing at some university she was at. So she had a touch for an understanding about housing, and I think that might have been also why she had a vision that this might fit there. I don't know what Mary Rouse's role in terms of that was, other than Mary has always been a strong advocate for child care, but I'm sure it was Shalala's decision, because of course housing didn't report through Mary, still doesn't report to the Dean of Students, it reports through John Torfey or the administrative or financial side of the university. But that was how that was done, and it isn't run so much, child care isn't run as a part of housing so much as it's a subset under the director of housing that is really run by Lynn Adelson, and she doesn't have line authority, I don't believe, over any of the child cares. They all run under what department developed them the first place, and she is sort of the expert facilitator, supporter, helpful spokesman, all of those kinds of things, which is a hard job, but I think one
it doesn't sound like a straight line organizational chart either.
No, it's kind of peculiar.
At the same time as child care was coming on campus, or approximately the same time, I assume you faced a challenge in housing, a cultural change in that employees groups where there were members of the family who were both adults and worked full-time and had children. How did you deal with that particular issue?
One of the things that I think made us aware of that as an issue was that quite a number of the senior staff, actually all of the senior staff, I believe, in housing were people who were, both of the adults in the home were working and had a young child. Alice Gustafson, in the time that I was there, had she and Gus, her husband, had Jimmy, their son, and so she's struggling with how do we both work and very conscientious people about raising their children. Bob and Pat Fessenden, Pat working at the university, and Bob had Craig and raising him. Paul Evans, three children. Kay Reuter Crowan, two very young children. So every day I'd come to work, everyone but me had issues with how to be a good parent, raise children who are young, and go to work. And so things would come up like, how do you get your kid on the bus when the bus leaves after you're supposed to be to work? So as we could, and I think no two people would agree, I think we were able to accommodate that, and we thought about it. And because these people in management had this issue in their personal lives, I think we're more sympathetic than people who came from another generation and that wasn't an issue when other employees had to have those needs. One of the things that is always an issue when you're in as big an organization as this one, the housing organization here, is there are five or six, seven different levels of administration. The director is quite distant from a lot of operations. And so you're never really sure that what you'd like to think is the spirit and philosophy of your organization is being implemented at all reaches of it. And of course they have, the managers out in those units have their own frustrations. But I think in terms of a family concern issue, we had that, at least in the administrative staff, the senior staff, and tried to have policies that were employee family friendly. Again, on the other side of it, of course, is the need to do the business that we're hired to do, and that's always a struggle. But I know we had people whose schedules were varied so that they could accommodate to their families. I don't know if we did enough of that. I don't know if we did it consistently along the way, but I sure hope so. And I don't think housing suffered for it. The morale of the employees, of course, is very important. But at any rate, knowing about the family issues was not hard to do because all of the senior staff except me had children to contend with. And they were all people that I would say were deeply committed to being good parents.
So, yeah, and that's just another one of these changes. You have more women in the workforce, you have more people continuing to raise families and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was in a way, would you do it sort of individually then? Is that what you're saying there?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I don't remember enough incidents that we did something unique to where I'm very good at that. I don't recall. I do know one of the senior staff quickly moved to working, starting to work at about 8:30 in the morning versus 8 because it accommodated
the bus schedule.
Yeah. And you know what you find in some of those deals is you wind up with broader coverage because you fill other times that weren't normally covered. I have always been a morning person and was in very early in the morning, but in my own family, I know this, there are people who aren't morning people, and to the extent to which you can accommodate people to the best time for their work, that's good. And hopefully try to do that. But on the other side of it, there's an awful lot of, again, as I said in Wisconsin, treating people fairly is treating them equally, and that means treating them the same.
Yeah.
And so slamming them into everybody is going to do the same damn thing at the same time. I have a little of that in my background, being from Minnesota. I hope not too much of it. When I look back on what I did and how I administered and probably throughout my whole career in housing, which is over 30 years, if I err on the side of one thing or another, it is that I should have pushed more for flexibility and individual decisions that accommodate people and less for consistency. And I think it's a cultural set, one that I was raised with. I understand it intellectually. I understand that fairness in some ways is treating people the same. But I think it's true, frankly, at Wisconsin, and I think Wisconsin's got better at it, but that if we erred as a university, it was to be consistent more than to deal with each unique circumstance and deal with it in its own unique way. So I think that I don't feel terribly bad about my my experience and time, but I think if I was to err, I'd try to now err more on the side of dealing with each unique circumstance. And if somebody said that's inconsistent with something else, I'd say, yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you. And we're going to do it anyway.
Well, what part of the problems you had, society was changing so fast that it must have been difficult at some point to see what really were changes in society and what were just sort of little things that happened along the way. Determining policy would be kind of difficult because you wouldn't exactly know.
Yeah, and coming from Michigan, which was a place where you more often made exceptions and dealt with the individual, I had to find what is sacred in this culture. And you know, I whenever I've moved, I've spent pretty much the first year not messing with things dramatically to try to figure out the culture and then live within it. But I think in doing that, I probably accepted too much this consistency and equal treatment thing. Not that this is a huge, huge thing, but when I look back on it more, I think the goal needs to be to help an individual deal with a large institution, and we need to be a little more accommodating and flexible about it. And I'm sure that chancellors more often would say that too, that they get frustrated when people do the rules or rules thing. And bureaucracies like housing are expected to be consistent and fair, and auditors really care about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
well, that's the other thing. You're accountable.
And I'd find, this is an aside, but I hadn't worked with legislators at Michigan to speak of because they weren't in the same town. And there are a couple of things I think about with legislators and even governors, and that is politicians, legislators, are very indignant about two things. One is if you make an exception for anybody else, any other rule than for them or one of their constituents, the only thing that makes them more furious is if you don't make an exception for them. This is really a fascinating thing. They want it both ways.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of times in which we had limited housing and we were having to turn people away. And being fair and consistent on that was terribly important. But legislators, if they had a constituent or their own family members, and I had more of those cases than you can believe, would want an exception made for them, and they were just furious that we wouldn't make it for them. But if they found out that any exception had been made for another legislator, boy, was that going to fry you fast. Shalala held with us very well in some of those really tough ones. I want to give her credit for that. And she and Harry Peterson, we had some tough ones. And when the university is lobbying legislators and trying to get the best face in the place, and we're not giving them what they want as individuals, even though they're wrong, it's a tough one to play. And I have great respect for Shalala holding to the point on some of those. On the other end of it, as I said earlier, Barry, I'm not sure but what being a little more flexible might not have been to everyone's advantage.
There's another issue that became, I guess, a rather hotly contested issue, and this has to deal with sort of the changing nature of family as well, and that's the domestic
partner.
The domestic partner issue, right, and that's in married student housing, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how that issue came to, rose up and exactly how it was handled?
Yeah, I'm sure my memory isn't total on this. It wasn't something that started with me. I think it started in a number of places, and frankly, it started nationally in some other locations. The concern, of course, here, should frame it, I suppose, is that people who are not traditionally married, are they having the proper access to things like housing, or are we discriminating against them in a way that we don't need to or shouldn't or is unfair? And the focus very quickly in this discussion goes to gay and lesbian couples, but in truth, as we dealt with this, we tried to stay consistent in our minds and our thinking that we weren't necessarily just dealing with those kinds of arrangements or families, but dealing with any circumstance in which two people of the same sex, regardless of what their sexuality was, were trying to do or accomplish. I'm pretty sure, actually, some gay and lesbian students raised this. I remember going to some meetings, and they weren't even specifically people who were intending to go into family housing, but it was a principle and an issue that the one I'm remembering is a committee that I think was a committee of the Dean of Students helped create, which was gay and lesbian bisexual student thing, and a number of us went to their meetings and they raised the subject, and we got to talking about it, and with some sympathy in housing. One of aside here briefly is, I hope, and I don't think I always did this, but I tried to have philosophic staff meetings, and I did this in Michigan as well, that would bring in someone who would speak about a subject that was controversial or I didn't know anything about, and to try to get everybody to kind of hear a different point of view, a different subject. And this is really a lot of fun because universities are full of these kinds of things. And some of these would have you change your thinking. Some would be on the forefront of change, and so you'd maybe at some point incorporate that into your thinking about your culture, that which you ran, and change things. And this is probably one of those. I don't recall that we had a specific meeting to discuss this kind of issue, but slowly meeting with the gay, lesbian, bisexual students and other things coming up, we talked about this. And there was a housing advisory committee made up of faculty, staff, and students outside of housing, and we talked about it there. I remember Bernice Durant was one of the people on that committee, and what we talked about in that particular setting, I remember, is what are our priorities with respect to family housing? And I remember most distinctly us arriving, again, this wasn't housing staff, this was a group of people outside of housing as well as housing people. What we arrived at is our highest priority should be children. And our highest priority should be to see that they have the best circumstance. How can we best support parents in helping them provide the best environment for children? This is how this started. And we got to realizing that there are circumstances where people who are parents didn't have access to our facilities on a par with others because of their sexuality or their partnerships, their arrangements with other people. And then, of course, this is a national issue going on. And and then the city, of course, had domestic partnerships as an arrangement passed through city council in Madison. Madison wasn't the first place, but one of the first places. And that raised the subject. If the city is concerned with discrimination in housing based on sexual orientation, what is the university doing about it? So that came to us, and that was another input. And so we're starting to think, the Housing Administration, that this makes some good sense. The Housing Advisory Committee thinks we got a reasonable plan, and we must have refined the plan over time. It didn't turn out to be very difficult. What we really came up with is, why don't we follow what the city came up with as a statute to define domestic partnership? And we'd say, anybody who's registered with the city as a domestic partnership will honor in terms of family housing. Well, we got this thing pretty kind of well set up, and then I learned in some other circumstance that it's very good to have forums, public forums. I've done a number of those over my time, and whenever I did them, I was wise to have done them. And we had two or three forums that were discussions on the subject. I know one of them was in the Memorial Union. I can't recall where the other one was or where they were. I just remember that one most distinctly. And people would speak for and against this, which is, I think, a good kind of Wisconsin tradition that in a civilized forum, people can raise and discuss and disagree. And I have to say, probably with bias, but those who spoke against are going to this arrangement, in my view, being prejudiced, I suppose, as I am, sounded stupid. Their reasoning was really not good. Those who were in support of domestic partnerships sounded reasonable, sounded family-oriented, family-concerned, children-concerned. And the more I heard and the more other people heard, the clearer it was that we should do this. And so we did it. We'd had forums. We'd talked to people. There had been, in other words, due process to see what people felt about this. And it was actually very well accepted. One input that Shalala made that was really very good, she had a gift of spending 2 seconds on a subject and giving you some of the best advice you'd ever gotten. And she said, one of the things that I'd like you to do is to have as a box that people check on your housing form, married or domestic partnership. We had originally thought we'd have married, domestic partnership, and whatever else. It turned out this was very wise because we have never kept records of how many domestic partnerships we have in family housing. And that's good in that we would get follow-up requests now and then. How many domestic partnerships do you have out there? People trying to, the press particularly, trying to find some issue to make of this. To my knowledge, to this day, there have been no issues with respect to who lives next door to who, anything related to domestic partnership couples out there hasn't been an issue in the way people live at all. And that we didn't have records, we still don't, I think, have records of how many domestic partnership couples out there is good. Yeah, we have made it sort of blend into the fabric of that community out there without an issue. I got calls from all over. I remember being interviewed over the phone with a public radio station from Oregon or Washington, all over, because it was kind of the time. But it wasn't that we went about doing this, I think, on our own. It was the city thing occurred. There were groups that did raise the issue with us. I think in the tradition of housing that precedes me, being open-minded to a different idea and seeing whether it fits and this is the time for it, that I think we could take credit for, and we did. And in this case, it made sense, and we did it. I'm sure there were cases in which people raised things and we didn't do them either. I, at the moment, don't remember any, but I suspect there were.
So you didn't really receive much flack for it once the program, not from the legislature or anything?
No. Like no, I think the chancellor's office may have gotten a call or two, but as I remember, there were very few questions about this. In fact, I think there were two. I think I got one letter from a member of the clergy against it, and there was one very outspoken faculty member in the medical school who wrote a letter to, and everything else was positive. But in truth, the most amazing thing is the volume of thought and comment that was expressed to me was just minimal, just very minimal. I had another one like this that you have on the list of things that we might talk about, and that was condoms on
campus.
Yes, okay.
Let's talk about a few of those and the Christmas tree issue, too. Okay. Why don't we get into those right now? Start with the condom issue. This is now we're switching from graduate student housing to the residence halls.
The condom one was somebody raised this to and wanted condoms in the vending machines in the residence halls, and I think it came up at the time, of course, that AIDS was an issue. It may have preceded that, but at least in my mind, I'm putting those two together. And we were worried about this. And I was pretty new in my time here, and I'm not sure I had a good touch for the culture and what was.
So this would have been about the mid-80s or something?
Must have been. It must have been middle 80s. And what we did on that one was we did a thing that presidents do a lot, and that is we floated it in the press. We floated the idea, and it was easy to do. I mean, if you raise this as a subject, you can imagine how newspapers would love this item.
Perfect.
And they ran that out there, and we hadn't done it. We just raised it as a possibility. Again, we got nearly nothing in terms of response.
Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, I was. And what really surprised me was, I think it was my wife was with some group, and who was meeting in some social way, I think, with other women who were of the age that have children in college. And the strongest reaction she got was, they don't have condoms in the residence halls? My God, what are they thinking? Well, our sense of it was it would be a reaction from those who thought we were encouraging sexual promiscuity nothing. Nothing to speak of. And you know, the other thing on those kinds of things, when you run public forums or have things in the press, legislators are following this. And they want to know what's going to come. And when they see nothing comes out of this, they stay out of it too. Yeah. That was a good one. And that one, I don't think I ever saw any of our vending machines that have had condoms in them. I don't know if it was ever done. I think it probably was, but it was a non-issue. Mm-hmm. And then we'll move to the Christmas tree one. The Christmas tree one, I don't think I'll ever resolve and may never be resolved because it is in this highly sensitive area of separation of church and state, religion, one religion over the other.
Well, the public schools have been fighting that same battle for decades now.
And it's the kind of thing that has done in school superintendents.
Mm-hmm.
And
that kind of stuff.
So I was leery of it. But one of the best learning experiences I was a part of, just sat in on, all my time in housing related to that one, and it isn't as though it was a learning experience that has the world have changed in any way, but for those who participated, I think it was a wonderful experience. And it was one of these times when the debate was, should we allow Christmas trees in the residence halls? We would get more refined about this. Should it be in dens? Will we allow it in rooms? Will we allow it in a main den? There were all kinds of variations of it, but at this particular time, and it was probably in the mid to late 80s, we decided, I don't know why, I mean, who came up with it, to do a forum on this. And what we're going to do is provide speakers an opportunity to speak for and against allowing Christmas trees we probably said religious symbols in the residence halls, because there would be issues related to symbols related to Judaism and all that too.
Now, are you talking about the public areas in the residence halls as opposed to the individual rooms, or
both? Came up, but primarily the issue was in the public spaces, because the rooms we've always considered to be individual people's domain and all. Well, we had a forum in the Computer and Resource Center, which wasn't called that at the time, I think. Actually, it was in the study room down at Gordon. And we made sure we had some speakers. I always had, I think, a good working relationship with the head of the Hillel, Sapoznik, something like that. A good guy. We'd have good discussions, and I'd meet with him every year, and we'd disagree on things. But we were respectful and appreciated each other. The goal being to make sure that housing was being responsive to the needs of Jewish students and open-minded to it. and we didn't always agree, but we had a good dialogue. At any rate, he, I'm sure others, and then students came and discussed this subject, and we had a rule, I think I may have moderated it, which was everybody listens to anybody who's speaking without comment, sits down. In other words, this is to be an academic, serious listening experience, mm-hmm. and everybody will participate in that way. Nobody gets talked down, shouted down, whatever.
Freedom of speech.
And yeah, and they were very good about this. And we had, it turned out in that evening, we had Jewish students speak for and against Christmas trees. We had Christian students speak for and against Christmas trees. We had atheist students speak for and against Christmas trees.
You had every combination you could possibly conceive raising their arguments on the issue of Christmas trees.
And they did it in a civilized way, and in a thoughtful, coherent way. And at the end, maybe a couple people changed their minds. Maybe some people who didn't have any opinion had an opinion. But everyone felt, I think, very good about the experience. It was really the kind of exchange that should occur in a university setting. It was civilized. It was thoughtful. It had depth. And I frankly don't remember, in terms of that particular issue, how we came off on the thing at the end. But I thought it was a wonderful experience. Maybe some of that was just personally, I thought that. every year this was an issue, and it was an issue every year, I'm sure it is still, how much to allow. And even in the housing staff, there would be a different point of view on this. And I don't know if I can remember who held what position on it. I tended to be more for giving people individual choices, and let's not get too vigorous about this, because the business of housing, I don't know if I've said this, I did a bit, is what got me in this in the first place, and that is being tolerant, understanding, respecting, and becoming tolerant and appreciative of people who have different views, attitudes, and beliefs than you have. And the normal flow of activity in a residence hall has people who are different in thinking, religion, and so on, in contact with one another, and all of us can become more tolerant and appreciative of the individual differences in the world if we experience people, find them human, find them likable on other bases than these belief kinds of systems. So the more we can expose students to different faiths, i.e., Judaism, its symbols, Christianity, its symbols, those who hold a point of view that is agnostic or atheistic, those kinds of things, I think we should do. I think this should be a forum in which people learn about differences and they learn the expanses of the world, not try to narrow it. There are people who disagree with that. But that is generally my belief on the thing. And in some settings, we've done that. And in some settings, just you can't. Mm-hmm. People aren't ready for it. It may have been that time, there was a time when someone defaced Hillel, there were some anti-Jewish reactions going around campus. It may have been that year, I don't recall. And that was, of course, an awful thing. And this kind of other environment where people can sit down calmly and reason about the goods, the bads, and that is a far better arrangement. So that was that subject. And I look back on that with real fondness.
Well, what about that Hillel thing? Examples of incidents like that happened in the city, on the campus, in the city, and in the country, for that matter. Did you ever approach that? Did you ever have forums within housing to deal with those issues? Or was that something that you waited until there was something happening specifically on the campus?
There may have been some, and I don't remember them. The student affairs people in housing would have worked on that. There were issues that occurred. The Res Life staff worked a lot on sensitivity to ethnicity, trying to make sure that minority students were treated fairly. And in fact, the first, I don't remember the name of it, but we had a minority student room dedicated to students of diversity before the university did.
Like a multicultural center.
Multicultural center, actually, that's right. The name of it. And I think we probably have two of them now. And that was, I think what generally you find in student affairs and also in housing student affairs people is a deep belief in diversity, all of those things I mentioned earlier about the educational value of diversity in residence halls and so on. And so they promote opportunities that make all students feel accepted, appreciated, treated well in the residence hall. So there was a history of that, and forums, I know at least on floors or in houses, we would have meetings on how to treat one another, sensitivity. You got, you know, students packed together in a facility. They need to learn how to be civilized and appreciative of one another, because you can have the Lord of Flies as an outcome, right, too. They're young and just getting away from home. Big issues, national issues. When, on occasion, if there was an issue related to the campus, I know some of the meetings that dealt with it, that the dean and student staff might be involved with, would be in the residence halls. Nothing's coming to my mind right at the moment.
Let me just talk about one other thing, and then I want to get back to the multicultural concept.
Okay.
If you do have a question, this might be a good time to tackle it. In terms of the dean of students' office, I mean, you guys are sort of in the same business. What kind of a relationship did you have with the office and with the different deans that you work with?
Mm-hmm. A good relationship, I think. This university has a different history than many in terms of student affairs. And it's not consistent from school to school, but many times housing will report to the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, and there wasn't that position here. The Dean of Students operation is more of a staff operation, or was, and was a parallel to housing in terms of hierarchy of the university, but not in the same hierarchy. It was in a separate one, reporting to the Chancellor. Our operation reported to Lynn Van Ness and later John Torfey, the Vice Chancellors for Administration and Finance. My thinking on that is that through the time I knew Newell, and I think before him, housing has always been, on this campus, viewed by the people who run it as a student service. So if those people have that commitment, that goal, that philosophy and orientation, that's the way it'll be run, and it doesn't need to be tied to a Dean of Students operation. It just needs to be run by people who believe strongly in student development, and it always has been. And that's, as I mentioned yesterday, why people like Newell survived an era in which most directors of housing got fired or retired early, because they were running it as a business operation. Newell, Larry, all of those people were running the place as though it was, the students were the customers, the students were paying the bills, we work for the student, we do what they want as best we can within what the university
guidelines.
They
kept their eyes on the ball. In other
they
words.
Did. Yeah. They knew who the customer was. And all of those guys, of course, had been residents.
Right.
And that also helps. They had some sympathy to it.
And house fellows in many cases.
And people like Roger Howard in the Dean of Students office had come out of housing, had been a housing
here. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Paul Ginsberg was a house fellow in housing here before he was a Dean of Students. There was this history of respect and appreciation, I think. On occasion there'd be issues. I laughingly remember so well me supporting throwing a student in jail who violated the trespassing rules that we had. We'd thrown him out of residence halls for misbehavior, and he kept coming back, and he was disruptive and a problem, and we told him, if you continue to do this, you're trespassing, you're going to go to jail. He came back, we threw him in jail. Ginsberg bailed him out. So the same university's throwing him in jail and bailing him out. So we had a different bent on it at the time, and yet I think there was always good respect between.
But the fact that you could do that is amazing in itself.
It was peculiar. But we had a good relationship with the dean's staff. The student affairs assistant director in housing has always met regularly with the staff of the dean of students. It's considered, I think, although not on paper, but in many ways a part of that staff, and consistent in terms of what we're trying to accomplish with the university. My background was student affairs. My background in housing was working in student affairs. And so that's consistent, I think. And Paul Evans, the director now, is a background in student affairs and was the assistant director of student affairs and now is the director, so has that knowledge, ability, background, respect, appreciation. And so they're separate operations, and on occasion we cuss at each other, but generally there was good respect. And my sense of it is, I've worked at schools and I've seen schools where housing reported to a vice chancellor for student affairs operation, and they were less student oriented than here by far. So it's a matter of the people, hiring the right people who have the right beliefs, I think, and hierarchies are kind of secondary to that.
Yeah. And having the tradition.
Yes, the tradition.
It's a funny word, and it's hard, it's impossible to define, but it just kind of hovers over everything.
Yes, it does. It does. And it's a great tradition here.
Let's return to minority students for just a moment. During your watch, the Center for Cultural Enrichment, I believe it was called, and a separate one, the Multicultural Resident Consultant Program, which was there to support minority students, were created. What can you tell me about either or both of those efforts?
The Center for Cultural Enrichment was started earlier, and it was to try to work on ways to have minority students feel at home and have their space in housing. Minority population in the university is small, and the minority population in residence halls is small. With a large housing operation, minority students scattered throughout feel if they are the kind of student who felt a need to be a part of a group that was minority related, could feel very diffused in housing, and we wanted to facilitate their feeling like they had a home or a center, a place that they would have a bit higher count in terms of the percentage of students.
Right.
So the Centers for Cultural Enrichment were an intention to develop that kind of environment, and the student affairs people came up with the concept and worked on that plan. And there were a couple of rooms that just have as a focus concerns with minority students. Come there, chat, sit down, study, watch TV, work on programs and that kind of thing. It was a mini version of, I think, what the larger university has in the union, or did have in the union when I left, for all students, but kind of a place in which they're just more of a focus on they control the place, they aren't lost in a mass white environment of a bunch of us Norwegians. And the other program, I have trouble with these names because they're a bit contrived and all, but we decided that
the Multicultural Resident Consultant Program.
Yeah, the Multicultural Resident Consultant Program was, in a sense, to try to develop resident staff like house fellows who would have a sensitivity, support, and appreciation for the needs of minority students, as they might be a bit unique to other students. They were not intended to work strictly with minority students, but work with majority students to appreciate the needs, differences, stresses, and pressures on minority students. So it was to try to improve the relationship, bridge the gap, show concern, show appreciation, show support for minority students. And what we did find back then is we on occasion would have a struggle trying to hire a sufficient number of minority students who wanted to and would be good house fellows. In part because they're going to be in this big white world, and that could be tough for them too. The minority cultural positions were more appreciated by prospective house fellow kinds of people, and helped us get more minority inclusion in terms of leadership in housing. I think they're still going on, as far as I know, these programs. They're good. Difficult programs, one I don't think we ever were able to resolve as much as the university would like, is Native American. There are so few of those students, and I discovered over my time here meeting with various tribal leaders and so on, that there's such a high value in the community and home for Native American students. What they really need is, I think, a separate building or house, and I think something like that was in the process of being developed here.
There was a center down at Johnson's, the University Avenue, I think, for a while, but I don't
whether it still is, I don't know.
I don't think so, but I don't know.
And that's a tough one because of a tremendously high
number.
Well,
also, the Native Americans, they were from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
We had several tribes in the 19th century.
Many, many, many of those students leave and go home because of the lack of the culture, the support system that they need. And I'm kind of personally favor and root for developing some colleges on reservations or in those sites. And I, whatever will help them get a college degree and come to leadership positions should be important to us. It shouldn't be that the University of Wisconsin-Madison dash has so X number of minority students. Our goal for minority students should be to help everyone get as much of an education and improve and advance and help them and their culture as we can. And I have felt that far too much effort is put in Madison trying to get its count and it competing with Eau Claire or someone else for the same damn students, when in truth the goal needs to be to help every one of those students succeed in college or whatever they want to succeed in. I wonder if you pooled all of the money that was spent recruiting all of these students, if we devoted all of that to just giving them the students and saying to these students, go to whatever college you want, if it wouldn't be money better spent. But the political pressures to have X number of minority students on each campus tends to be overwhelming, and it's a tough one.
There's another group that began to become more vocal and more noticeable in this time period, and those are people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. You had the American Disabilities Act, which came, when was that passed?
It would have been in the 80s, too.
Yeah. How did housing, and of course here you also have things like special needs, wheelchairs and mm-hmm. things like that. How did you people at housing deal with that issue?
The issue for us in a lot of ways was a physical issue. Elevators, proper coding, rooms that had closet shelves the right height, and actually I think we worked and kind of struggled through it, as we did with so many things, meeting with the students who had these issues to deal with and then to try to accommodate to them. I think what we found over time was our goal needed to be to help each individual with whatever they needed that would support their unique circumstance, versus to try to have some standard that applied to all. Because the truth of the matter is, everyone who has some kind of a need is a little different than somebody else's need. Mm-hmm. And if you say, you're in the handicap room and the shelf is such and such to accommodate you, and they say, but that doesn't work for me, saying that's tough is not a good answer.
Right, right.
And so I think our philosophy developed to be such that if people would give us sufficient lead, we could make accommodations for them, and we did. We, over time, were able to do more and more things. When we got Merit House, we specifically mm-hmm. designed into that, I think one apartment, maybe two, that are really accessible and have been real valuable to students. Resident needs, you know, the technology's improved to where now we have better elevators, now we have better alarm systems for people who are deaf and those kinds of things, and we just worked on it, I think, in parallel to what was going on at other schools throughout the country. I think still the toughest deal at a place like Wisconsin is snow, weather, that
yeah,
kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
I, of course, periodically talked with Trey Duffy in that office, and before him, I think Nancy was her name, but the woman in the Dean of Students office who worked on issues with students with disability. And that's been an evolving philosophy, and there certainly were times when I would have pretty solid disagreements with people in that office. I think all of us with the right intentions, but I have to say that I didn't always agree with them. I thought particularly that they had a difficult role to play, to be both an advocate for students with disabilities mm-hmm. and to be an objective reviewer mm-hmm. and advice mm-hmm. giver. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think we ever resolved that, Trey and I, over our time. But I think things have become clearer. I think things got clearer after the young woman in law school sawed a desk in two with a chainsaw or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot all about that.
And that didn't happen on my turf, and yeah. I was kind of tickled it happened, because I think some things needed to be clarified, and I think that helped with that. My father was crippled, and I was raised with someone who had a disability, so I think I've always had sort of a unconscious sympathy for people who have difficulties, but I don't know that we did anything exceptional. We were with the momentum of the culture. I greatly appreciate that a culture such as ours has cared about people who have some limits, and the proof of a culture and its development and its humaneness, I think, is how it treats people who have more struggles in a culture. And I think the Disabilities Act and working to make it possible for people who have some limits to do what they can do today over what they could do years ago has been great. And a lot of it, of course, is attributable to the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Before that, I think the big push was, of course, World War II and those kinds of things. But I don't think I have any profound things on that, Jerry, to say that we did.
Well, it's interesting. All of these things we keep saying about the mid-80s. And yeah. When did Norm come into being here? Wasn't that about 1983?
83, so...
So you came, and all of these movements were just sort of coming to bear on campus. And again, they would come first or very early in places like housing. Were you under any government mandates to provide ramps or to improve elevator service in certain buildings, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet I don't think they were. We moved along at a pace that seemed to be appropriate to the concerns of the college, the university, the state and federal kinds of regulatory agencies, and usually that stuff was as you make renovations and changes, you do these things. Mm-hmm. However, we moved ahead of that on things as we could. There are always competing interests in terms of what you can afford to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we always cut it right, but I think we made the steps that we could along the way. And elevators are very expensive, but the technology in elevators and lifts and so on improved all the time. There were things to learn in the remodeling at Eagle Heights, those apartments. The various things we tried on accessible bathrooms and showers, some of them were miserable failures. Mm-hmm. But the intention was right, and actually in that time, the technologies were developing as to what works well for a shower, what doesn't, and we'd get caught in those things too, but not in that anybody was trying to not do what was right. I think there was a good cultural set moving in the right direction, and you know, one kind of shower is a roll-in shower, and you find you flooded the whole damn bathroom. Another was stackable washers and dryers, and of course they'd work beautifully for somebody, and they were hell on wheels for somebody else. If you got the washer up here, the dryer up here. And there's no simple right way in all of those, but if people want to work together in it, you can. We had, on occasion, somebody would try to take us to court. One fellow who was allergic to about every fume, smell, whatever, and you couldn't really find the scientific basis for some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh, we ran ourselves ragged on him. The smell of lighter fluid on someone's charcoal who charcoaled outside near his apartment gave him problems. Mm-hmm. These are hard things to deal with. And we struggled and we cussed and we screamed and we did things, and somehow or another you survive it all.
What about alcohol and drugs? How much of a problem was that with housing?
Drug
use. Right now, we're in the middle of, there's a lot of binge drinking. It's a big, huge, huge focus here on campus. So let's just turn the clock back a little bit to your watch.
I doubt that changed from the time I was here. Wisconsin has had a tradition of a lot of drinking. Mm-hmm. I really don't know that it's changed. I don't think it increased. I don't think it decreased. As many people would say, we have a culture that does a lot of inconsistent things about drinking, and it promotes and then on the other end says that people shouldn't do it. I don't know that we did anything phenomenal there. We did drug education,
regular standard,
that kinds of things. I threw out a lot of students in the time I was here. I think the most was 50 students in a year.
Wow.
It strikes me. And I would say that 99% of those students that we threw out, whatever they did, also involved alcohol.
You mean in terms of destruction of property? Or
we had something called the Big Five. If you do any of these things, you get thrown out in the first offense. Those were quite a few of the bases for throwing people out. Tampering with firefighting equipment, fire alarms, anything that could be, throwing things out of the 10th story that could beat mm-hmm. somebody and
yeah,
kill them.
Yeah, right.
These were pretty reasonable five, mm-hmm. big five things. But about everything that I dealt with involved alcohol. It was a rare occurrence to throw somebody out for other than an alcohol-related thing. And it just, of course, is poor judgment related to alcohol, and we didn't allow people to use that as an excuse. We, with the dean's office, tried things like non-alcoholic parties and that kind of thing, and I know there's the Robert Wood Johnson study that is trying to help us come up with ways on the campus to deal with drinking. I was a part of that group when I was here, and I think things that made sense to me that are, I think, in operation now are trying to get students to recognize there are many, many students who are at a university who don't drink, but you don't have to drink to be in. And I think that's a good way to approach it. Peers, students emulate other students. They don't emulate bureaucrats, and they probably shouldn't. But that's a real uphill run in it. And it really isn't entirely a university thing or a college thing. It's a cultural thing.
It certainly is.
I would say one thing about this as an aside, about how we deal with students, students' behavior, misbehavior, and so on. I think sometimes we in this culture make the mistake of making exceptions, excuses, and providing more opportunities for support for college students than we do for the kid who got out of high school and goes to work at Penny's. No one I hear of is spending a lot of time worrying about the poor kid who graduated from high school and goes right out in the world to work, and what are we doing to program him, to teach him, to actualize him, to develop him, to deal with his issues and problems. And how much time do we spend in the press and on the university campus caring so deeply about the best and the brightest?
Good point.
Now, that isn't my business because I've always been on the campus, but I can't help but say I do wonder about this. The best and the brightest seem to get more support, treatment, concern than the kid who just gets out of high school and goes to work. And I sometimes wonder if we know how that student is behaving, or if in fact maybe that student is behaving in a more mature way than the kid who comes to college. And the kid who comes to college kind of takes on the behavior, what they think is proper college behavior, which is getting drunk out of your mind,
right,
and that kind of stuff. But I don't think I have anything great and wise to say about that.
One quick thing, let's turn to drugs for a second. When I was in college, marijuana and LSD, and it was a very, very contentious issue. I mean, you could really get yourself in all kinds of trouble, not only with campus authorities, but with the police and everything else. What about, by the 80s, that huge, it had kind of quieted down a little bit.
Some.
But what were you dealing with in the 80s and the early up through the late 90s?
There were some instances of drugs. The exposure I had to drugs was more at the University of Michigan. That was that time there, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And LSD and kids tripping out and so on. Didn't see as much of that by far here. We did have a few cases. One of the suicide cases that occurred when I was here, I think it was felt that the student had taken LSD. I don't know that. You know, a lot of that investigation at some point occurred with police, and we knew what we had a need to know and not all kinds of things. There were on occasion marijuana busts. There was an incident or two off campus. In fact, there was one in which I think there was a sale that went bad and some non-student shot and killed a student over on University Avenue during my time. So I think marijuana use and some other drug use has continued to be a factor, but it wasn't a big part of...
It wasn't as contentious.
No,
you didn't have to, the police roaming through the dorms,
no,
not busting down doors or anything like
that. No,
uh-uh. Yeah. No. You mentioned suicide. Was that kind of thing common? I mean, how many of those did you have during the course of...
I don't remember.
You know, I don't even think of things like that.
Yeah.
You just said it and my stomach just kind of fell.
Yeah.
Of course you have to deal with that and with crime and with rape and with even... Did you have any homicides or anything like that?
Not here. Yeah. Did at Michigan.
Oh,
we had, I'm guessing here, Barry, but probably about 6 suicides, a lot more attempts. In my time in housing, we've seen more dysfunctional families, or at least we know about them more divorces. We had some bad experiences with people, both in Michigan here. This actually was a better environment than Michigan, but where parents actually were looking for a way to get rid of their kid and sending them off to college. We had kids who were sent to college here who psychologically, mentally had no business being here, that needed to be in a hospital. And on occasion we would have to, the Dean of Students Office would see that they were removed from the university. But the residence life staff, the Dean and student staff, has had to spend a lot of time working with students who are potentially suicidal, who attempt suicides. Of course, the health center, the counseling center do that as well. And I don't know if the frequency of this is increasing. I think it was increasing for a period of time I was here. Culture is more complicated. Students feel more stressed for whatever reason. And so there were those issues, and there were successful suicides. I'm just kind of guessing at six. I remember a couple of specific ones. But when you think about it, you've got a lot of people living on campus, family housing, residence halls. I think we figured with families and so on, I don't remember how many, 10, 11,000 people probably have as their living environment campus. And in that size of population, anywhere in the world, you probably find a frequency like that. One of the things that was troubling on occasions, didn't happen too often, but when a suicide might occur in a residence hall, the kind of the ignorant, stupid, quick reaction was that the fault was to some degree the building. Mm-hmm. It's really stupid, you know. I mean, people can go anywhere and commit suicide or attempt suicide, and on occasion you'd find a sense of people thinking it had something to do with the resident environment or something, and it didn't. Mm-hmm. I suppose it could have, but no more likely to be related to their living environment than it would be to their stress in the classroom or their problem with their parents or those kinds of things. It is a tough time, young people growing up and struggling, and it's an awful thing. I think that this campus had developed a real good sympathetic protocol that worked with these kinds of incidences. Are we clouding over?
So finish your thought.
Well, just that I think the university does a good job with that. I think the tradition of people like Paul Ginsberg developing that kind of structure in the Dean of Students Office, a caring one about individuals, is a good one. And there's nothing you can do in those circumstances to make it go away or right, but hopefully you do as much as you can to intercede before that comes to be the case.
Well, but it's a slice of, you know, it's just this community out there like any other. Yeah. And again, you forget about sort of the underbelly sometimes and things about like suicide, and these other horrible things that are a part of life.
They are.
Let's leave that and let's go to, just as you were developing programs for all these different things like domestic partners and you had different issues to deal with, like condoms and vending machines and Christmas trees and all that. You were also developing different types of living learning communities on campus in this period, which have come to play in many instances a very important part of life on campus. Let's talk a little bit about the concept of living learning communities first. And I'm going to tab you as an expert since you worked at the Michigan Residence College. And if you could just kind of frame the issue as you said it, and then we can get into some of these specific communities that were started during your years as director.
I think the idea of a living learning environment or a residential college, it doesn't have one cookbook approach to here's how it's done. The idea, I think, people hold is you can't separate the learning environment from the rest of your being, your living in the world. And if you can bring all things together, living, eating, studying, more informal relationships between students and faculty, you're immersed in learning in a total way, in a comfortable way, that learning is easier, better, you're a better student, immersing yourself, I guess, in the learning experience and not separating from it the world experience, that's a better environment. And then people, that's just a kind of a quick thing on it. And then people vary in their thinking about how they would configure some environment to accomplish that. And the Mickeljohn experience back in the 30s was one of those, an early one. And then there have been, I think on a 20 or 30 year cycle, these kinds of programs mm-hmm. come up.
For societal reasons too, the particular time in history that.
I think probably times that there's a strong belief in cooperative or socialistic kinds of governing structures probably complement that too. And I got involved in one of those at Michigan, and there were things I learned, I think, that I learned from that experience. And then they were starting one called the Centennial College at the University of Nebraska when I was there before. And I saw that a bit. And one of the things that I came to think, and I think I'm still right, and this is a secret, so you won't tell anybody,
but those who are sealed.
And that is, housing professionals, student affairs people, people who know a lot about the learning environment residence halls can be, have, I think, generally felt combining academic programs with residence halls is a very good, positive way to both help residence halls, help learning, help everyone, a more personalized education, a less large bureaucratic amorphous university that is impersonal and caring. Living learning units kind of make things more personal, closer, and care about people. They housing professionals in the student affairs area have always, I think, felt that's the case, or at least in my time. However, if they approach academics and say this, academics tend to reject it. No, that's not a good idea. We like to do it the way it is. The way we do it in the classroom is great. That's the right way. Get lost. And if they have been able to co-opt some faculty into getting involved with these programs, it's not with the enthusiasm and commitment that is required, because it requires a deep commitment, a personal commitment, to go to meetings, to go to night activities, to talk with students and so on. If you can get faculty to think this is a good idea, this will work. It can work. It has a chance of working. So, when we thought we might have a chance of doing something like a living learning environment, an academic residential program, Kay Reuter Crowan, the staff in housing, with my advice in this case, would try to find someone who really believed in this, who was on the faculty, and for us to work very hard at not taking credit for getting this going and for not overly developing it ourselves, but to work very hard at trying to find faculty members and facilitating, helping, supporting them, helping them by getting them to go to conferences, helping them by getting them literature, helping them by supporting them, helping them by believing in them, providing support systems for them, to where they could build an administration and a belief in a living learning concept that then has its origin or starting point be in the academic area. And we worked very hard behind the scenes to be supportive, and even more than supportive, in getting these things going. We found some good people, Aaron Brower,
Social Learning Center.
Yeah, who had a background from Michigan that I didn't know there, but we had people in common, who would then know someone else on the faculty, or Kay, or someone would know, and we got Michael Hinden. I don't know if I can remember all the other names, but there always are, in a big university like this, a great diversity of people on the faculty. And if you can find the right ones who really love teaching, who really love students, who really want to do it another way, and you can get them together and then support them and help them, give them credit for it. Find a way to have the university respect and support these people and give them credit for time doing this, you can make this work. If you try to administer it from a housing or a bureaucrat standpoint, it will fail. And I think this is a thing that I did bring here that was a different approach to this. It's not an intention to be sneaky. It is to know what will fail and what has a chance to succeed. Mm-hmm. And what I saw from the Residential College at Michigan was this grew out of LNS, Literature and Science and Arts, and it had people with deep, solid academic credentials create this program, and those of us who were administrators helped them, supported them, backed them up, found the money, did those kinds of things. That's what we've done here.
Before we leave Michigan, did they have the problem? A lot of the people who get it are, let me make a generalization, yeah, then you tell me if it's correct or not. I would assume a lot of the faculty who got involved in this were the younger people on the faculty. Is that an accurate assumption?
It actually was mixed. The dean of the college and Ted Newcomb were at the far end of their careers, in their 50s and 60s. But they were just open-minded, visionary people.
Where I'm going with this is the culture of academe. You get rewarded for teaching. You get rewarded for doing research. That's how you get tenure.
Yeah.
That's how you get your salary advancements. That's how you get all the different perks for getting off semesters to do this and that. Was that hard to fight that?
Well, you know, in a way, Barry, what that has you realize is it has to be senior faculty members, because the young people are struggling and clawing for tenure,
right,
getting their grants, getting their support. You need people who are secure.
Yeah.
Who will get involved with this. And you know what?
It's David, a different breed of cat. It really is. Go ahead.
David Ward said this, and I think he had a good point. He said it about a different thing. What he wanted to have involved in programs, I don't remember what program he was talking about at the time, he said, I think it might have been academic advising and so on in the faculty, were faculty members who had a kid in college, about to go to college, or just having completed college. Because faculty can tend to be really not caring, sensitive, supportive people of young people until their own kid is dealing with this faculty member who's a jerk. And then they become a little different. He's right about that. And I think we probably found, too, when I think about the faculty I know who have been involved in the programs here, they tend to be more senior, credible people in the university environment who are self-secure enough to take on something different and believe in it and make it work. And so we've had good success with that. One of the struggles, and so we have the Bradley Learning Experience that we got started and with really great faculty involved with that, and then we threw as much financial resource behind that as housing could. Chadburn Residential College was another one of those experiences. The one that I really like is the Women in Science program.
Talk about that.
That's when I left anyway, it's still a relatively small program, I think maybe 70 women who live in a section of Elizabeth Waters, and they are people who are in the science area, aspire to be in the science area, are interested in the science area. Generally, I think are good students in the science area as well as probably other areas, but the sense of it was that there aren't good support systems for women who are interested in sciences. The science area was dominated by men, very few faculty women in the sciences. Can we share with them some role models, some support, who are women who are successful in the sciences, who will work with them, speak with them, listen to them, just be more supportive to women in sciences? And so this is a real modest little program. It basically has them living together and then some good faculty advisors and people who will work with them. And one of our problems there was finding good faculty women who had the time, energy, touch to work with these young women in college. And the difficulty there was we're looking for women at the same time as these women are struggling in the science areas to get tenure, have children, all of that kind of stuff. And I think they have some very good people. I hesitate to use the names at this point, but that I was tickled with. I thought, there's a real intervention we can make. There's another program, I'm lacking for the name of it right now. Do you have
Is that the Global Village House?
The Global Village House is another one, then there's another one. Global Village is trying to, schools have done this forever, trying to put international students and U.S. students in contact with one another so that both learn about these different cultures. And we use Merritt House, the building that was given to us by the Stone family, to do that. Good program. Again, it's not one you really do anything other than you put these people in an environment with one another and they just gain and learn from one another. And I think it's very consistent with the goals that the Stone family had for that building. Then there's the
We have two honors houses. We have an emerging scholars house.
The emerging scholars house was another one that was kind of interesting. That one came out of, I believe I'm right, a faculty person, I think in Texas, somewhere else, had tried to work on programs that would support the development of students who were struggling to succeed, and many of them being minority students, and found if they lived together, studied together, and went to class together, the likelihood of success increased. Part of it is, you know, if you increase the focus on any group of students, I think their success rate increases. But this one was taking students who are, I think, more at risk And providing them good faculty support and sensitivity. And I think it started out in the math area. I think that's the strongest area. I think Phil Certain's wife worked with us some. And we housed them, we did then, I don't know if we still do, I think in Celery, a small program, again, one that I think was intended to help students who might be at risk. And I don't know what their success rate is. In terms of measuring success in all of these experimental programs, it's a tricky business because you have to define what success is. And I think Aaron Brower is doing the research on a number of these programs, the Bradley Learning Community at the Chadburn Residential College. My way of thinking in many ways, success is students who at the end of 4 years have graduated at a higher rate, have done better, who are broader, have thought more, who are better people for it. Those are hard standards to measure. honors programs are kind of another thing. I worked with those some in Michigan, and they can be an elitist kind of thing, and I'm not sure I like that part of them. It also defines if this is honors, everyone else isn't, which is not true. But where there was a need that housing could meet on the university campus, we tried to do that, and there was an interest in honors programs, and so we...
Who expressed the interest?
You know, I don't remember at this point. Whether somebody, I don't remember, Barry, somebody else would have to tell you, but my reaction is, sure, if there's a group of students who want to live in an honors environment, fine, we can do that. One of the things about all of this, these different programs now, what did we mention, 5, 6, 7, and then we've got, I suppose, the traditional student, but every building, of course, is different in some way or another, too. Is at some point toward the end of my time here, there was a concern with, okay, so what is the definition of housing and what is our goal for students? And this is sort of, I think it's a kind of a Wisconsin concept, and that is we have to tidy this up. We have to have a one phrase meaning, here is the direction we're going. This is this
one
kind of tidy consistency. And I must admit to this day, my reaction is why? If we have a multitude of programs, they're different. Students can select between them, some like a traditional residence hall, some like the Bradley Learning Experience, and we can meet the needs of a variety of diverse students in providing these varied and different offerings. Why do we need to have all housing the same? Having all things the same in housing sounds like something a housing bureaucrat would say. I don't say that. Other parts of the university who want to tidy this up, I'm a little surprised at, because usually other parts of a university would be critical of the mindless lockstep approach the bureaucrats in housing might have to running everything the same way. So I think that debate's going on, and it doesn't interest me, frankly. I think we should change things if at some point a program that we have is no longer meaningful to students. Let's dump that, start something else. Let's have no sorrow for what no longer is relevant. Let's move on to what is now more relevant. Keep changing. The world is always changing. It should. And that's what housing should do. And that is the tradition of housing. I think I would say that would be a tradition of Newell and his crew, too. And it is back to what do students want in housing? How can we do that? Not is what does some bureaucrat or some higher administrator or some legislator want in housing. What do the students, and the students, of course, somebody should know who's listening to this, housing is self-supporting. Students pay for it, pay for the mortgage, they pay for the buildings, they pay for the operations. These are the people that we're here to serve, and we should be providing the housing that they want. And I think the history of the place has done that very well, and I hope the future will too. But it is not to be narrow and lockstep. I think it is to be broad. Try things. It's a little bit of the Michigan thing where try it. If it doesn't work, we'll dump it. But let's not try to figure out all the reasons why it won't work or our need for consistency first. Let's try something, and then if it works, great. If it doesn't work, let's not, you know, wallow in that too long. Let's move on.
You talked about Women in Science and some of the other dorms and their programs, and they're rather small. There is one that started recently that isn't small at all, and that's the Chadburn Residential College. Let's talk a little bit about that. That's Chadburn Hall. That's, goodness gracious, that's 650 students or something like that. How did that come about that such a large program began?
The start of that was before I'd ever met him. Bill Cronin was interested, I think, in doing something at Residence Halls. Hadn't contacted us, and I think if you asked him, he'd probably say, would have thought, we'll not get any housing bureaucrats to do that in this place. And his experience had been at one of the Eastern schools, I don't recall which, that he had been a
Yale.
Live-in kind of person with. And of course, it is the case that most housing people who are professionals in this field know more about these experimental programs than do faculty. But, as I said earlier, if housing runs forward with these kind of programs, they aren't going to work. You need faculty who mm-hmm. are supportive of them. So he either contacted us or we contacted him. I don't remember anymore. He talked about what he'd like to see. We worked with him to try to accomplish what he thought was a vision. And I'm sure that Kay Reuter Crone, Marion Lanes, the housing staff who worked in student affairs, worked very closely with him and his staff in developing his thoughts. He originally wanted Tripper Adams, I think, and they didn't work. And of course,
was that in homage to the experimental college?
I think somewhat. Yeah. I think also that the most sought after buildings that
right,
they had,
beautiful buildings.
And they aren't accessible, yeah. And so we couldn't do it. And they were meeting a need anyway. And then we looked at three or four buildings. Arriving on the plan for Chadbourne, I was real skeptical. It's too big. I thought it was too big. I can't say now whether it's turned out to be as successful as he'd hoped or we'd all hoped. But I think they have had good success with it. I don't know the specifics of it at this point. It was kind of coming into being when I was leaving.
Can you compare it to the Michigan experience that you had? They both say residential college, yeah. So they immediately think, they're both the same.
No, but absolutely different. Michigan, we spent in 1969 dollars, a few million dollars on this old quadrangle, redoing it to add a library, auditorium, faculty offices, classrooms, and all of that. We haven't spent that kind of money at Wisconsin on these programs. We have basically taken a building as it exists, thrown a $100,000 or so, I don't know what, on a little bit of office area, and that's about it. I think its proximity to faculty offices is good, but it isn't anywhere near the kind of development that Michigan has done. And of course, one of the things that you have at Michigan is a very different approach. Michigan prides itself at having the highest room and board and tuition rates in the Big Ten. And if it ever thinks that anyone's creeping near them, they raise it again. Wisconsin's on the other end of this. And, you know, Wisconsin is kind of caught and maybe struggling a bit with low cost at all costs still. The trustees, the regents, everyone worries that we keep the cost of the university down and affordable. And I think that's a noble goal and a great goal. But on the other end of it, it takes money to do things. And if you aren't putting any money into it, you can't do some things. And there hasn't been, to my knowledge, any funding of any of these academic residential programs outside of housing money.
Well, I think at CRC, at least, they charge the residents an extra $300 or something a year. Which they use then for bringing in speakers and you know, providing programs.
We run through the housing part of it. The college, the university has to contend with that and decide. And you got to spend some money. And I'm sure that the administration of the university knows that. But they're not sure where all this is going and are a little suspicious, I think. But I think housing was very responsive to the desires, the goals that Bill Cronin had. I think he needed help with administration, and I think he got it. I'm sure there are things about it that aren't perfect in terms of his mind's eye, and that'll always be that way. I don't know that it's perfect from the perspective of housing people either, but I don't really know how it's doing, frankly, at this point. If I run into, what's his name, the researcher I was mentioning earlier, who's doing the sociology, guy. I don't know what kind of data he's collected, that will say something to it. But I think higher education is always changing, and it should change, and the housing should be responsive, not resistive to it.
Well, you also have a again, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm not correct on this, but I would assume that when you start these different programs, like Bill was so, Cronin was so very instrumental in starting this, does it become a person-specific program?
That's a concern.
That would be a concern. Anybody who knows Bill Cronin knows he's a very charismatic person, and he's a very intense person. And Bill left this last semester, and Mary Leone, whom I don't know, I think comparative literature perhaps, has taken over this semester. So it's going to be very... Is that a concern in any of the other programs that you start, that like in the Bradley Learning Center, that it's too people-specific?
It can be. Now, the residential college in Michigan has been going on for 30-some years and has gone through administrative changes. But then again, LNS there puts a lot of money into it, raises young people in that regard. We're pretty modest in terms of what we do in that. I think the Bradley faculty had a group of something like 6, 7, 8 faculty were involved in it. And I think as there's an evolution there, there will be people with the history, and it'll probably work all right. It may be that Bill is so much his own person that it would be hard to develop a continuity and all. And maybe over time, they'll have to build more of a triad or some kind of a group of people who run it. But you've raised a good point, Barry, and I don't know the answer to that.
Well, you also have part of the beauty of these different organizations, not just CRC, but all these things, is it's a little bit of an edge city type thing. You know, they're sort of on the edge. If you give them too much bureaucratic support, then they're not where they were before.
Yeah.
And maybe it's best that some of them do die after
that
a while.
May be true.
You know, and then something else will come and take its place and get that enthusiasm and that support that you need.
Providing a small personalized experience in a large university is a positive thing. And to the extent to which these programs do that, regardless of what they talk about or offer, I think students can feel lost in a large institution. Mm-hmm. And the smaller identification with, say, the Chadbourne Residential College or Bradley Learning Experience will make the student who graduate from here feel more tied to some manageable sized entity in the university. And I think that'll be a positive. But you're right. You can make more of them than should be made of them. And personally, I don't care. I think they should change. I would say this about even my time in housing. My job was to manage housing as the best I could in the time I was in with the needs of students and the university that came before me at that time. Mm-hmm. If everything I do is undone within 10 years, I think that's fine.
Right.
And I think Newell would feel the same way, and I hope Paul would feel that way too in the future. I don't mind change. I don't mind that what I thought was sacred at one time be done differently. That's the beauty of life. And administrators' jobs are to administer, to make things work in the time they're in with the resources they have, and to not try to make things so that they won't flex with the future, and I think I'm pretty good about that. I don't look to have a legacy, the future. My goal would be that people look back and say, he didn't screw up too badly, he tried to be responsive to the needs of the time, but not that my God, something Sunstead that is still going on and we can't kill the damn thing, you know? or he would roll in his grave if this changed. I don't want that. Frankly, I personally have always been fascinated by people who are concerned what their legacy is anyway. I really don't, I want to be measured at the time that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and the future be dinged. That's not mine to control. I shouldn't be trying to control it. The world will change, and I just can accept that. One thing I wanted to say that is a big change in housing. Things take a long time to change, on a national level, a big change. When I was still at Michigan, and Reagan was in office, Reagan eliminated the College Housing Loan Program. This was a federal program that at one time funded a loan program for people to build housing, and it really occurred to help after World War II with providing housing on campuses for returning vets to go to college. And every dollar that was repaid to the College Housing Loan Program became available to build more housing. Mm-hmm. It was a rotating fund, and it kept interest rates very, very low, 1.5%, very, very low interest rates. Reagan killed that, which was really stupid, and I have no idea what the gain was, because this was all money that was already off the books, so to speak. All of the housing that was built during Newell's era was all funded with college housing loan program money. That is not available now. Everything that is done now is an outside loan at far higher interest rates. And what does that do? It requires larger room and board payments to repay that kind of money. And that has that was a great loss. It took many years, of course, for it to take effect. And I really feel the future of housing on college campuses is not going to be built by and operated so much by college housing programs, but by private entrepreneurs. It is now viewed that housing, and you see it in the developments in Madison, is the purview, the domain of private developers. It is an opportunity to make money. What does that mean? It means it costs more. College housing is a break-even operation, university-run housing. Private businesses don't get into it for break-even, they get into it to make money. Now, to some degree, politicians like that because they pay taxes. But you have to weigh the value of the tax money you make off of those properties against what the increased cost is for students to go to college and afford to live on campus or to live in an environment that supports them. You have to weigh that they're living in apartments versus living in residence halls where they meet people of varied and diverse backgrounds. I think they do that less in apartments. I think there's less exposure to different cultures, different beliefs, different values. So I personally favor residence halls, double-loaded rooms, double-loaded corridors as a learning experience. But I see the future being there won't be more university-built housing, and that will be too bad. But that's, again, my saying that I don't care. Don't want to control the future. It is a concern I have for the future. Yeah. But the future will be what it is going to be without my direction, and that's
well,
okay.
Well, I'll learn it. You've had your chance to at least state your case.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good place to close the interview today.